Hi. Before the episode on 9/11, we wanted to include a quick tribute we put together last minute to a very important person here at Seacoast who passed away over the weekend.
Hey guys, I'm Jeff Surratt. I'm Pastor Greg's brother, and I'm Pastor Josh's uncle. I served on staff at Seacoast from 1996 through 2010, and a part of my heart will always be there with you. Today, I was honored when I was asked to come on the podcast and share with you a tribute to my friend, Lori Fitzgerald. It doesn't seem real, but Lori passed from this life to the next this past Saturday, September 9th. I met Lori 25 years ago when she applied to be my administrative assistant at Seacoast. Within days of hiring her, I realized that I now worked for Lori. She organized my schedule, she sent me home when I forgot to bring the things I needed, and she laid out exactly how I needed to do my job. And she was usually right. For 25 years, Lori was behind the scenes, helping shape much of what Seacoast has become. She did it all with her good-natured sarcasm, her razor-sharp wit, and her deep care for her people, an ever-growing tribe I was soon adopted into. Lori was more than a co-worker at Seacoast. She was a ministry partner, a little sister, a caring friend. Lori faced more obstacles than almost anyone I've ever known. She experienced seizures while pregnant with her first son, Sean. Her second son, Michael, was diagnosed with autism at an early age, and her husband, Adam, went through multiple brain surgeries during the time we worked together. Lori rose to every challenge, always quoting her mantra, "God's got this." And she shared her faith with all of us, asking us on Facebook every Sunday night, "How can I pray for you?" We wanted to share with you a few clips of Lori telling how God eventually healed Adam in 2019 during a series of extraordinary healing services at Seacoast. You will hear Lori's humor, her grit, and her extraordinary faith coming through.
Have you ever struggled through, "Why, God, why can't I just have a little bit more of a normal go at life?"
I don't know that I ever stopped to think about it because I'm a doer. I'm a list person. So I would just make my list. I have my bag. I'd go take care of things. Done. I never really thought about it. Now, when I'd be sitting in like waiting rooms or in the hospital room or whatever, then I would be thinking about it. Like, okay. You know, because people are texting you and they're like praying for you. Well, thanks. Need it. But I never had any worry. It was always a peace that passes understanding, like ridiculous peace, always. And I was terrified. And I was pretty new in my faith. And I was like, "I'm going to be left alone with these two little boys. I don't know how to do this."
Terrified that he would not make the surgery, yeah. Make it through.
Yeah. And, you know, because I didn't know anything about it. But it was great. You know, I had my small group. My small group came around me. They helped. After that, every time I'd just be like, "All right, God, we got this. We're going." That was it. Like, I never worried. I've never worried about him when he's had a surgery, except for that first one. So I knew that the healing service was on the first Wednesday, and I was like, "Sweet, I get him there, get him healed, we go home."
That's what your expectations were?
Exactly. I had a list. I had, you know, "I'll get him there, I'll get him healed." Because it happened in January, it's going to happen for me.
Right. When you said, "I'll get him healed," did you have in parentheses, "Well, actually, Jesus"?
No. Because if I got him there, then I was going to take responsibility.
But I don't feel like I have a gift of faith where it sounds like you have a gift of faith.
I think because it's been proven to me so many times, and it's been a journey to get here, but like when he had his stroke a few years ago, there was no reason that I should have known there was something going on. He did not present at all like he was having a stroke. He did not. To me, I thought he was weird. But I said, "Get in the car, we're going." I drove him to the hospital, and he had a stroke at the hospital. That, to me, is God showing me something that I wouldn't have otherwise known. I feel like I've had that so many times over the years with his medical stuff that, yeah, I would say it's a very strong faith. I believed in the healing from the minute I set foot in the chapel to ask them for healing prayer. It didn't matter who prayed for him, you know, but from the day that I walked in there, I claimed it. He's going to be healed. So now I'm definitely more vocal about sharing the experience that he was healed, whether I know the person or not, which it's not my personality. I don't really talk to people at all. And so talking to people I don't know, right. Is, you know, and about something that may not be comfortable and I don't know how they're going to receive it, that's kind of hard. But I made a promise that he's healed. I'm going to share this with everybody. Everybody's going to know what God did for my family.
Lori was a phenomenal writer, and 10 years ago, she wrote this on her blog. Frog Boy asked me the other day what I would do if I only had a month to live. I immediately asked him, well, what condition am I in? Frankly, that's going to make a big difference in how I answer the question. If I'm confined to bed and unable to communicate, I think it's pretty obvious I'm just going to lay there no matter how long I have. And if I'm kind of sickly and I can't get out and do fun stuff, then I guess I would spend a great deal of time gathering the people I love around me and talking about good times and telling them that I love them. I can talk faster depending on how bad I feel. Door number three is obviously the door of choice. This would be where I'm amazingly healthy up until the moment I stop breathing. Behind this door, I would like to think I would do all sorts of fun things and make all sorts of incredible memories for my loved ones, things I would remember for the rest of my very short life. Although, let's be honest, if I'm dying in a month, even a good solid poop will land on that list. But then I think again, do I want my kids to come to the end of my life and say, hey, remember how awesome mom was the month before she died? Or do I want them to remember my entire life, hopefully in the same awesome mom vein? The night before my aunt slipped into a coma she never came out of, she told my uncle, if I die tonight, I will die a happy woman. It's been a little over a year, and we haven't come anywhere close to exhausting the awesome mom stories from her life. I want to live my life like she did. No matter how long I have, no matter what I have happen, I want to live a life of love. Last Saturday morning, Lori exited the world stage through door number one, but she fulfilled her wish. She lived a life of love. Our hearts and our prayers are with Adam, with her kids, Sean and Mikey, and her grandson, Daniel. Their family, our Seacoast family, will never be the same without her. But we look forward to seeing her again when we get to join her with Jesus. Thank you for listening to this tribute to my friend, Lori.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or as a podcast?
Yeah, as a person.
No, I like you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna lead. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about.
I was the receptionist at that time. Our staff was much smaller, and everyone was in their place. We worked in the trailers, but it was right beside the church. And so the phone rang, and it was Pastor Greg. It was the church phone, not like our cell phones. The church phone rang, and I answered it, and it was Pastor Greg. He was actually in Chicago at a meeting. He said, Kathy, I need you to get online immediately book me a car. I'm going to be driving home.
And did you know about the attacks at this point?
I did not. And then he said, and I need you then to go into the church. All the pastors on staff had a meeting on that morning. He said, I need you to go and interrupt them. And then I need you to turn the TV on in the church. I annoyed the pastors when I interrupted their meeting. And Pastor Greg's brother, Jeff Surratt, was the one leading. So he walked out. They all came out. And the staff all got around the TV. And we watched in disbelief.
Not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane. We just saw another plane coming in from the side. So that's the second explosion. You can see the plane come in just from the right-hand side of the screen.
And after a while, Pastor Greg and Pastor Jeff, they had talked by then, and we as the staff were given the opportunity to go home to our families, or we could stay, whatever we wanted to do. So Pastor Greg drove home.
Was it a challenge to book him a rental?
It wasn't for me, because he realized immediately that air travel was going to be grounded. So that's the first thing he said.
So y'all were ahead of the game.
Yeah, he said, grab me a car. But within just a few minutes, the cars were gone. So Pastor Greg drove home. The message that he already had planned for that weekend was changed. Pastor Greg addressed the congregation on the tragedy. And as he always does, he reminded us of God's promises, and he gave us hope.
I'm Ross White, campus pastor in Greenville, and I heard about 9/11 in the accounting office at the Greenville Hospital System, where I was working at the time. Someone, I think, heard about it, maybe on the radio they were playing in their cubicle, and I remember we pulled out a TV from a closet, and we watched the unfolding news that day. It's interesting, the things that you notice in times of crisis. I had an office which was on the third floor of the building, but it had an entire wall that was a window. And there were always planes flying around and jets leaving their contrail in the sky throughout the day. But I'll never forget that day because the empty, vacant sky was surreal.
So my name is Julie Hyatt, and I am at the Greenville campus now, but in 2001, I was at the Mount Pleasant campus when the morning of 9/11, my husband called to say that a small plane had flown into one of the World Trade Center buildings. We tried to find news because back then, you couldn't just click on Fox News on your phone. One of our staff was able to find news and put it on the monitors in the hallways of the church, which is where we spent most of the afternoon glued to that TV for any news we could get.
This is Josh Walters.
On 9/11, I was attending the University of South Carolina, and I remember walking in the Darla Moore School of Business. I used to seeing hundreds of students coming and going from class, but on this day in particular, it was standing room only. The breezeway was full, and they had rolled tube TVs on these big roll carts out. Couldn't see what was going on, and it was awkward because no one was saying a word. I remember walking up the steps to see over their shoulders as to what was playing on TV in disbelief as to what had happened.
Hey, this is Tim Lindsay, Dream Team pastor at Seacoast Church, and I remember exactly where I was when the attacks happened on 9/11. It was around 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Zurich, Switzerland, when my wife called me at my office and said something terrible had happened in New York City. I switched on the TV, and my coworker and myself just saw the Twin Towers burst into flames and crumble. And the weird thing about it was, even though this was America, even though this wasn't a city that was in my country, it felt like it was an attack on my country. It was an attack on my city. It was an attack on me.
Hearing military jets flying overhead, couldn't see them because you were in the smoke stream.
This is Fred Reed, an elder at Seacoast. He was actually staying at the Marriott World Trade Center Hotel on the morning of the attacks. While taking a shower, the first plane hit the North Tower, which was connected to the hotel.
But I distinctly remember telling Joe, I said, Joe, if somebody told me right now that Godzilla jumped out of the harbor and is wreaking, knocking over buildings, I would have believed it. I would have believed it. It was that bizarre and surreal.
And so we got the permission to set up at a school about six blocks from the Pentagon.
This is Denny Nisley, a Seacoast member as well.
And we got there at like 11 o'clock at night on September 11th.
Him and his wife, Sandy, founded and lead Christ in Action, a nonprofit, faith-based disaster relief organization working across the United States of America, bringing hope and help in times of crisis. His team showed up at the Pentagon the night of the attacks and shortly after served for weeks at Ground Zero. Here's Pastor Joey Svensson and Roy Jakes sitting down with Fred and Denny to hear their stories of that dreadful day in American history.
Here's what's baffling to me. We're going to be very generous and say that people have vague memories at 2 years old. Very generous. So 1999, if people were born in 1999, there's a possibility they have vague memories of 9/11. So that would mean everyone 23 years older, or 23 years old and younger, did have no recollections.
Yeah.
23. I mean, we're talking people in their 20s. It's history, and they did not experience. That's just crazy.
We were having this conversation just recently. I don't even remember why, but I was commenting to the people in my office, like this was the defining moment for our generation. Like everybody remembers where they were on. You don't have to, when you hear September 11th, that's all you have to hear.
Right.
You don't have to have a reference. You don't have to have a date. September 11th immediately is a defining moment for those of us who lived through it.
Yeah. I was thinking through, there's just certain parts of 9/11 that if you didn't live through it, you just have no concept of it. And I wrote down, I don't know if it's possible for my kids, for example, to really get the gravity of it. Like, I can say this is like a defining moment for your parents' generation. Okay. You know, I get it that it's a big deal.
Yeah.
But and then another one is the unbelievable unity that we experience as a country. I like, especially in this day and age and how polarized we are. I want to say, if my memory serves correctly, that there was footage of Democrats and Republicans from the Senate or House or something on the steps of the Capitol building, like singing hymns together. I mean, you don't see that nowadays. So that was unbelievable. And then I think I would tell my kids the sadness that was just permeating all society with COVID-19 and how it was affecting your lives is very different, and maybe more, the emotions were more compacted in a smaller amount of time, but there was just a sadness. Yeah. I mean, we were just all, it was just super, super heavy.
It's the Pearl Harbor of our generation.
That's right.
Yeah. Where were you, Roy? How did you find out?
Oh my goodness. I looked it up. The first plane hit, I think 8:46 is what I saw. I know where I was in that season of life. I was working night shift at UPS. I would have just gotten home, about 5, 6 a.m. that morning, had gotten dressed. I was in seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and I would have been getting dressed to go to class. I don't remember exactly how I found out, but I have the pictures clear as day, sitting in the recliner. We were in a small apartment in Louisville. I can see the living room. All I did was just sit in my recliner with the TV on and just dumbfounded, watch the coverage. And that's all I could say. Just dumbfounded. I couldn't believe what I was watching on the television. I could see the scene in my mind clear as day.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a middle school math teacher. And so what was interesting is my first block of math, it wrapped up around 10:30. And so my boss, the assistant principal, was coming door to door and just basically saying, hey, just letting you know what's going on in our country, planes flying. And there's like a part of me, it's like, okay, I know this is a big deal because you're making an effort to go by each teacher's classroom and have face-to-face and tell them, but it's like, I don't really understand. Okay. You know, I think a lot of people thinking, okay, it must be a small plane. You know, that's probably what was going on in my head. I just had no idea, but I knew it was something, you know, a big deal because of her going door to door. Fred, your story on a scale of 1 to 10, as far as craziness and what you went through, where Roy and I would be maybe at a 1, you're like at a 10.
Yeah, 10 plus. I mean, it was one of those things where you're experiencing it and you're taking processing one step at a time.
Yeah.
It's interesting you said about your thoughts initially. This is a small plane, you know, and that's what we thought. On the ground, it was a small passenger plane that had an accident, right? It wasn't until we left the area and ended up in Staten Island where we were in a restaurant. These people were offering us food and water. We got to see the footage that y'all were seeing on TV and actually seeing the attack. And it was at that moment that I had this concept that someone actually was trying to kill us.
Wow.
Yeah.
And yes. It was amazing.
Take us through that morning for you. Why were you in New York City?
I worked for a company in Charlotte. We were developing power plants, and General Electric was the lender. And we usually have a closing dinner, and these guys chose a restaurant in the village. And if you're, you know, restaurant in the village in the city, then we would have to overnight. And we usually stay midtown. And for some reason, the folks that, you know, were in control of the logistics set us up at the Marriott World Trade Center. And, you know, it's a short walk from there. And it was perfect evening. Got to the hotel.
So is this between the Twin Towers? I mean, geographically, yeah. It's like between them?
Yeah, okay. It's actually connected to the North Tower.
Okay.
So it's physically connected to the North Tower. Part of it looks over in this courtyard where there was a sphere that you can see, and a beautiful area. That morning, got up, I was in the shower, and I felt the hotel actually shake. Wow. So I'm in the shower and the building is moving from side to side. And it sounded like, and I'll never forget this sound, it's almost like a hydraulic sound, like if you were in an elevator and the elevator got cut loose and it was just tumbling down.
Wow.
And so I got out of the shower immediately. My cell phone's ringing. An attorney friend was also there, Joe Tironi, and he calls me. He says, "Fred, something has happened. You need to get out." And I said, "Joe, what?" And he said, "There is a woman on his balcony with her eyelids on fire and her forearms on fire."
On his balcony.
On his balcony. And I'm trying to process what he's saying. And Joe's a serious guy. He's not gonna fool around like that. So I'm trying to process. I'm shaking in the shower, and now I'm standing there listening to Joe, and then the phone goes dead.
Oh, wow.
I'm a Navy nuke submariner, and so I usually prepare the night before. So I've got everything packed. I've got my clothes that I'm going to wear that day. I'm standing there, and I'm going, "All right, what do I do next?" And your mind kind of breaks it down to one step at a time. And then all of a sudden, there's this tremendous knocking on my door. I look through the peephole, and there is a Marriott guy, a tall man with a bushy mustache. He looks disheveled. He says, "Get out. You got to get out." And that's when I first started noticing an acrid smell in the air, almost like wire insulation burning, that kind of smell. So I go, "Okay, you don't have to tell me twice." I put my clothes on, grab my gear, and it was a rollerboard and my backpack, and I start walking out into the hallway. There is everybody, if you can imagine, emptying out of the hotel rooms, going in one direction, and I just follow everybody. We go to a stairwell,
and I'm curious: do you have the noises of that moment in your head? Like, were people screaming, or were people just quietly, just like, "We got to get out of here"? Like, or you don't recall?
Oh no, I absolutely I do, and it's weird.
We're about to find out soon how your brain protected you from visuals. So, but you remember how it sounded?
I remember how it sounded, how it smelled. People were they weren't in a panic, chaos. Everybody's hustling down the hallway. We were on the seventh floor. Got to a stairwell and went down maybe one and a half flights, and the people stopped and you couldn't go any further. And what had happened was, in the stairwell, it actually collapsed. So it looked like laser cut concrete and steel, and you couldn't proceed any lower. So we backed up in whatever floor that was and went to the length of the building and went to the other side stairwell.
Wow.
And that one was open. And so we were hustling down to the deck, the first ground floor.
What floor were you on?
I was on the seventh floor, Denny.
Wow.
And so we got to the lobby, and I open up to the lobby, and they've got makeshift cots on the floor. There are injured people on the floor.
And at this point, what does Fred Reed think is going on? Or do you not have the luxury to think about it? You're just...
I'm just reacting.
Yeah.
And what happens for me, everything slowed down. So you're making decisions kind of like left foot in front of the right foot. Go down to this pass, almost like you're in a maze. and you can't go any further. So you back up, you find the next opening. So I noticed there were civilians in charge, and they were taking charge over certain areas. And we went to the front door. There were officials there saying, in groups of five or six, when you open the door, I want you to run. Do not stop and do not look up.
Wow, my God.
And I'm going, okay, I've got to listen, you know, to the instructions. So I did that and ran out. Now, in my mind, Joey, I'm looking at a clean sidewalk, no debris, nothing like that. Okay. When I was up in the elevator and I looked out, not the elevator, up in my room, and I looked out of the window, I could see like what looked like pieces of paper on fire floating down to that globe that was on, in the courtyard, right? And I thought, well, that's strange, right? And you're trying to make sense of it. And so now I'm walking in that running in that courtyard. I don't see those burning embers. I don't see people on the ground. I don't see anything like that. And I just ran into the street. And I'm heading towards Battery Park South, towards the water, towards the harbor there. And all of a sudden, Joe Taroni shows up to my right side, and he's running with me.
Oh, my God.
And I look over, and I'm thinking, what are the odds of that? The running slowed down to a walk, right? And so that I remember there is a sky bridge, and we were on the other side of the sky bridge, maybe a block and a half, two blocks from the towers. And I look up and I can see both towers on fire, both smoke coming out. And we're standing there in just utter amazement, right? The smoke was going towards the harbor. So you couldn't, it was going overhead at that point. And we're trying to make some sense out of it. And I'm looking at Joe and I'm looking up and I could see people jumping out of the building.
You could see that
with my own eyes. But here's this is a weird
reaction.
Is this
hard to talk about? I guess enough time has gotten. Up the stuff?
No, I've been to counseling and you know, the company I work for set up counseling for everybody to kind of process what was happening. But the thing that I noticed and the question I asked Joe was, why does everybody have black suits on? Mm. My mind is processing it that they've got black suits, and Joe says, Freddie, that they're burned. They're burned. Now, where they were falling, I couldn't see because you had the sky bridge, and so I couldn't see the event. And I didn't see anybody on the sidewalk. Oh, I found out later on from the counselors that your mind protects you, that others that were in that same counseling session from the company said no. Well, they saw bodies on the ground that we were jumping over them. And I didn't recall that. In my mind's eye, it was clean sidewalks running out. So I looked at Joe and I said, look, I don't know what we've got to do, but I'm afraid that the building is going to topple over. So like a tree would fall over. And I said, we're still two blocks from this thing. Wow. We got to get out of here. And he says, okay. And just at that time, the building started to pancake.
Right after you said that?
Right after I said, well, I don't know the exact timing, sure. Joey, but in my memory, it happened right afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it occurred almost slow motion. It was like it started to pancake and just fall on top of each other. And that's when the wind, that's when it got dark. And that's when the ash and soot and all that stuff just came on top of us. And it just knocked us over.
People you couldn't were escape running. It. It was completely.
There was no way you could outrun it.
Wow.
No. And I had glasses on. Joe had contact lenses on. But my glasses had like an inch, 2 inches of just ash on it. I had to wipe it off. Joe, unfortunately, got a lot of that debris in between his contact lens and his eyes. Mm-hmm. And so to this day, he has still problems, detached cornea, and they continue. Wow. They can't remove enough of material to kind of clear it.
That's crazy. See, I can remember. And those are the images, right? I can remember watching those scenes, obviously not living it, but I can remember watching that soot cloud just blow down entire streets, right?
Yes.
People trying to.
It covered everything.
Yeah. People trying to get into buildings, but anyway. Yeah. They were right in the middle of that.
People in the building.
Do you know this? Did you know his encounter? Was this crazy?
Honestly, I've heard it before. I've heard it before, so I knew he was there. But the details now. Yeah. I mean, just crazy hearing the details again.
After Joe and I got up and we're just walking, running away from the towers, there were people coming out of buildings with bottled water, tossing out, trying to help folks. We saw baby carriages knocked over, right? And we were running to the baby carriage to see if there was a child in there, but it was empty. And we just, masses of us, were heading towards away from the buildings. We got as far as we could, and we got to the water, the water's edge. And I remember hearing Coast Guard in a center console directing people with a megaphone to walk right to left away from the stream of the smoke. And he asked to kind of get out of it. And so we did. And the masses of us, and there were thousands of people there, up against the water fence, and then finally cleared that smoke trail. And that's when people started trying to call out. And nobody's phone would work. The cell phone, you had no coverage. It was like, right? And you just couldn't get out.
Yeah. What was the vibe? Was the vibe Team Humanity is helping each other out? We don't know what's going on, but we have each other's back and we got to take care of each other? Or was it just chaos? Everybody is looking out for themselves.
No, it was team. Everybody teamed up. And that was unique. That was undeniable.
Wow.
Everybody tried to help.
But at this point, again, you still don't know what's going on.
I have no idea.
That's what I can't fathom.
As a matter of fact, when we were walking down towards the water, we kept on hearing military jets flying overhead. Couldn't see them because you were in the smoke stream. But I distinctly remember telling Joe, I said, Joe, if somebody told me right now that Godzilla jumped out of the harbor and is wreaking, knocking over buildings, I would have believed it.
Oh my God.
I would have believed it. It was that bizarre and surreal, right?
Now, did you have in the back part of your mind, but something hit the building? Because I remember what happened in the shower. Like, did you connect those dots?
Well, sure. Because when you, before
it could have been Godzilla's tail.
Yeah. But
could have been aliens.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, I can't even fathom being in that scene and what, like, is the world coming to an end?
Right. Is this happening everywhere?
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah.
So, I looked up and I saw the smoke and the flames coming out of the building. So I know something had to hit the building at that level. Right. But I had no idea what. As a matter of fact, I forgot to mention when I was going down the stairwell in the Marriott, my phone starts ringing. So I had these BlackBerry phones, right? You remember those?
Oh, yeah. There's a movie about it now. Really? BlackBerries, yeah.
My phone's ringing, and it's my mom. My mom calls me, and she says, my son, something bad happened in New York. And I said, yeah.
Mom. She didn't know you were there?
She didn't know I was there.
Wow.
And I said, yeah, I'm right in it, right in the middle of it. She goes, what? And the phone goes dead. So I put the phone back in my pocket. And then, so now I'm at Battery Park South and trying to use that same phone, could not get out. And then all of a sudden, one guy gets out. He yells out, I got out. So he's talking to his wife. And then we started just doing a daisy trail, right? A chain. And we said, look, here's my phone number for my wife. Call her and tell her, you know, that I'm okay.
Wow.
And everybody started doing that. And so this lady started calling other people wherever she was at and started giving them 5 or 10 names. And so somebody called Terry and said, your husband's okay. He's alive. He's out of there.
Wow.
And that was the first that she heard that it was, you know, that I had gotten out.
Yeah.
But at this point, still no idea what happened.
When did
Terry? Wow, that's all that stuff behind the scenes that you have no idea what's going on.
Like your perspective of 9/11 is vastly different than the vast majority of Americans. Like I truly believe that if you were in the city or with, you know, we're going to hear about Denny's, you know, the recovering that you did, there's an element of 9/11 that I can't wrap my mind around that you can. You know, I saw it all on TV.
Was Terry watching all this? Like when did she, you know, after the fact, obviously, or when did she become aware of what was going on?
Yeah, when that lady, somebody's wife, call Terry to give her the report that I was okay.
Gotcha.
And I don't know when that was because I'm rolling out trying to figure out.
But she wasn't at home watching the news or like at, when somebody called her, that was the first she knew anything was even going on.
Yes. Yes.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And actually, we were in Charlotte. We were living in Charlotte. We had painters. They were painting the outside of the house. You know, this thing hole rolls out and the guy stopped painting and everybody's on a radio on a device. And, you know, she's trying to figure out what's going on. And it was the first call that, wow. that she got, because I don't even think she knew where in the city I was staying or even relative. Right. Because usually I'm in Midtown.
Yeah. And, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Well, I was just thinking even so she didn't have to even live with that moment of watching this going on and wondering, is my husband alive? Yeah. By the grace of God. I mean, she didn't have to deal with that bit of the story.
Yeah.
First thing she's finding out is my husband's okay.
Yeah. And then her next thought was the children. And so she wanted to get word to the children because the children were starting to find out about what was going on and things like that. So,
And so how long did you, where did you spend the night that night? How long did you stay in New York City? I don't even remember the timeline as far as when planes were allowed to fly after that. I mean,
it was several days before things got restored. So I'm at Battery Park South. We're out of the smoke. We got the word out. The Coast Guard guys told us go right to left and continue to get out of the smoke stream. And we got to a point where the Staten Island ferry comes into Manhattan. The ferry docked. The gates opened up. And at this point, the second tower had not fallen yet. Coming off of the Staten Island ferry are squads of firemen holding picks and axes and other tools. And they're literally double timing in squad formation, running to the World Trade Center. Jeez. And once they got off the Staten Island ferry, then we got on. We, whoever was lined up there, and we packed that ferry thick, right? And so we got onto the ferry. I'll say this, Joey, my reaction was to flee. My reaction was not to stay and fight, right? And I had to really work through that in counseling. It was like almost a survivor's guilt, right?
Yeah, like why didn't I try to help other people?
Why didn't I try to stay and work like a fireman and try to help? Instead, my thought was, and I can speak for Joe as well, we got to clear datum. We got to get out of here. And get to safety, flee to safety. So we got on that ferry and the ferry got into the harbor. And again, once that wind started kicking up, because it was a beautiful day in New York, blue sky, sunshine, gently breeze, man, it was a phenomenal, gorgeous day. Once you got onto the harbor, all that dust and stuff started going back into your eyes and stuff. You had to clear it. I remember having the taste of concrete and steel and rubbish down my throat. I tasted that for a long time afterwards. I remember years later doing replacing a sidewalk in my Charlotte home, and that machine was breaking up the concrete, and he was making the concrete into dust. And I remember smelling that dust, that concrete dust, and it took me right back to September 11th. That same smell, that same taste. So we're on the ferry. We got to Staten Island and we get off the boat. And literally, I had a thought. It was like what you would see in the Middle East during any crisis where you have refugees just kind of crawling their way out of an attack. And I'm looking at this road going up to the main street where the Staten Island ferry left us off. And we're literally refugees walking up, it dust and all that crap all over you. And the first place there was people offering help was this restaurant right at the top. And these guys were giving you water, food, setting you down, wanting to hear your story, helping you, you know, wiping blood off of people's faces and stuff like that. And so I'm sitting there with Joe, drinking the water, just trying to wrap our head around it. And that's when we first saw the TV in the restaurant. And that was our first images of, by this time, they had the planes crashing into the building. And that's when I remember getting angry with the thought that, and this is the first time I've ever, and only time I've ever experienced this, that someone calculated and made a plan, and it was personalized, to kill me.
Yeah.
Not that they knew me, but these were a collection of actions that I was in harm's way to be killed.
Right. It wasn't incidental. It was on purpose.
Was on purpose. And that's when I started to get angry.
Yeah. How did you get back home? How long did it take?
It started getting late in the day. And I mentioned to Joe, we got to figure out how to get home and what we're going to do. Everything was shut down. They shut down all the bridges into the city. They shut down, travel trains, any way to get in and get out. And so I'm originally from New York City. I'm originally from Brooklyn, from Bensonhurst. So my first thought was to call Jean Misery, who was a neighbor. Jean's was my mom's age, right? Called her and she said, no, she thought I was in North Carolina. She said, no, it didn't happen in Brooklyn. It happened in Manhattan. I said, Jean, I know. I was there. I was there. Where can I go? What do I do? She says, oh, my daughter, Francine, lives in Staten Island. Where are you?
Wow.
And so Fran came and got Joe and I, and we spent the night at Fran's house. And then that next morning, we got up early in the morning and we got across the bridge, Bayonne, New Jersey Bridge. And we picked up, we were lucky, we couldn't get a rental car. We got onto a train, and the train, we started heading south towards Baltimore. So we got to Baltimore. We overnighted there, and then I got on a Greyhound and a Greyhound through 95 back to Charlotte. But we drove by the Pentagon, and you could see that going in. And it was just like, I just want to get home. And then a side story on there, on the Greyhound bus, we had this character in the back, and he decides that he wants to start smoking a joint. And the bus driver pulls the bus over and says, sir, you got to put that out. You got to put that out. And he's argumentative. And everybody starts going, what are you, lost your mind? Look at what just happened. Put this, the joint out. And he finally did. And we got back on. But I'm thinking, what else is going to happen? Right. So I got back. It took me like 3 days. I got back at 4 in the morning, got a cab, went home. And I slept for like 2 or 3 days.
If 9/11 happened in 2023... the vast majority of the bus would have been smoking a joint, probably. Yeah.
Denny, they'd have been passing them out at the front when you get on.
Denny, I want to hear how you found out, and then take us on your journey. And obviously, the organization, I'm pretty sure that you found and that you've been running all this time. Give people some insight on what you do and how you ended up in New York City.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Fred. That's just
still trying to process that conversation.
I know.
it's amazing. I was at my house. I live 40 miles from the Pentagon. And that morning, somebody called me and said, hey, you got to turn your TV on. Somebody just flew an airplane into the Sears Tower. And I'm like, the Sears Tower? So I went, turned the television on, realized it was the World Trade Towers. And I'm watching in disbelief. And the name of our organization is called Christ in Action. We do disaster relief. So people were calling left and right and saying, you got to get to New York. You got to get to New York. But I'm looking at the Pentagon up in flames. And I really believe the Lord put in my heart, said, you need to go to the Pentagon. And so I started making phone calls to politicians and people in Congress, people that could get me connected. And we finally got permission to set up. We have the capability of feeding 15,000 meals a day. And so we got the permission to set up at a school about four or five blocks, maybe six blocks from the Pentagon. And we got there at like 11 o'clock at night on September 11th. As we got there, they said, no, we're going to close this place down. They're not going to use it. And I had my semi trucks there. I had all my food and my staff. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I want to help these people. And this young lady came over and said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to feed people. And this is our capability. This is what we are. And she goes, let me make a phone call. And she came back and put me on the phone with somebody. And they said, what do you want to do? And I explained to them, I said, I want to feed the recovery workers and the people that are injured that still haven't cleared out and so forth. And so they put me on the phone with the FBI and they said, we'll need to clear you. You personally and your organization took all of our information, said, we'll call you within 24 hours. And I'm like, 24 hours? Gosh, yeah. So we left our trucks there, got in a van and came back to Manassas where I live. By now, by the time we got home, it was like 5 a.m. I took a shower and I laid down in bed. All my guys were sleeping on our sofas and stuff. I told my wife, I said, this is bizarre. I was laying there about 10 minutes. My phone rang. It was the FBI. They said, you and your organization have been cleared. Aisle 11, South parking lot, the Pentagon. I'm thinking, well, that was quick. So I jumped up and I looked at my wife and I said, I don't know that we can do this. It just, the whole thing was so overwhelming. And she looked at me and she said, Denny Nisley, there is nothing that God has called you to do that you can't do. And I just kind of squared my shoulders away and we loaded up the van, got the trucks. One of my pastors was with me in the semi truck. I was driving the lead semi and we got to the exit ramp and there were two Humvees with 50 caliber machine guns mounted on them. And as I looked straight down the barrel, I could look in the eye of the guy that had it trained on my head. And I stopped as they told me to.
Yeah.
And I said that magic 4-letter word and they left me through. I said, food. I said, we've been cleared. I gave them the security password and they opened up the gates and we went through and we set up. We have a 8,500 square foot tent. We have a tractor trailer that opens into a stage with a generator in it. And the tent attaches to the roof of the semi trailer, makes it an indoor amphitheater that seats 1,100 people.
Wow.
And so what we did is we used that as the dining room for the recovery effort on the parking lot. And our generator, it's a 60K generator. We have sub panels that we ran off the generator and we powered probably 80% of the South parking lot until they could get other generators in there. We set up and the first night we served beef stroganoff. We set up a serving line and Christ in Action was responsible to have 5,000 breakfasts cooked and served by 7 o'clock in the morning. And then we would cook half of the lunch dinner. And then the Red Cross and Salvation Army would cook the other half of the lunch meal. And the evening meal was completely served by Red Cross and Salvation Army. And we brought in volunteers from across the country. And to make a long story short, we served over 55,000 meals in 17 days. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff sent out a retired chaplain. He came out to help take care of the needs on the parking lot. And our ministry, we teach a lot of critical incident stress management all across America. And I became the go-to guy for the people that were carrying the bodies out of the rubble on the parking lot. They didn't want to go to the mental health tent because they were afraid it would go in their record that they needed mental health and that they needed counseling. So they would come to me because I'm just the preacher that sit down and talk to you. And I counsel guys that after carrying 4 or 5 body parts out at a time, they're like, I need to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And we'd sit down over a bottle of water and I'd walk them through it and talk to them. And we had people, dignitaries come, I don't know how many senators and congressmen and dignitaries of the U.S. government come through to see what we're doing and how we're doing it. And they would always say, this is Dr. Nisley. He's heading up the recovery because the Joint Chiefs of Staff sent out Major General Robert Smolin. And Major Smolin and I became good friends. He would direct everybody to me. He would say, this is Dr. Nisley. He's heading this up. You got to ask him. And being an evangelist, I have a doctorate's degree in evangelism. We do this so we can reach people for the kingdom of God, that we can counsel them through on biblical principles. And they would talk to me. And I got to share my testimony of how God delivered me from drug addiction, from alcoholism. I was crippled, and they were wanting to amputate my leg. And the day I got saved, Jesus healed my crippled leg, and I've been walking on it since April 3rd, 1977. When I gave my life to Christ, I would share my story with them, and I got to share my testimony with like Senator Ted Kennedy. I got to share my story with Jesse Jackson, and as it turned out, the young lady that opened the doors for us to get there was a staffer for Jesse Jackson Jr., Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. And she said, "I am the liberal left-wing people of the government." I said, "Well, I am the right-wing radical conspiracy that Hillary Clinton talked about." And we got along so well. And Sona and I are friends to this day.
Wow, that's great.
And she's still radical left wing, and I'm still radical right wing. But we found a common ground. She visited us every day on the parking lot. And I can't tell you how many recovery workers, how many military and government officials that I was able to share salvation with, pray with them to receive Christ. We had 5,000 breakfasts ready, cooked, and served by 7 o'clock in the morning. And we fed the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff and their staff. And I was invited in to address them. And I got to share my salvation story with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their staff. And God just opened up so many doors on that parking lot in 17 days. And then when we were finished there, we were invited to go to Ground Zero in New York City. And we set up at the South Street Seaport. And we got apartments in Battery City Park, which that's probably where a lot of the people evacuated down to the river. The apartments were empty because people had either evacuated or they were not alive. And we served another 50,000 meals to first responders and down in the hole. I owned Lower Manhattan on a golf cart with food and coffee. And I would go down in the hole. I was all over Battery City Park. I'm there between a limousine and a bus on my golf cart. And people were waving out the window, saying, "Hey, Brother Denny." Everybody knew us because we were feeding everybody. We talked with people. It would take months. And the story that we heard earlier about people jumping out of the building, I would have people a month, 2 months after the event that would come to me. I remember one young man came. He said, "I need to talk now." And he was there the day the towers were hit. He wanted to talk about seeing people jumping out of the buildings. And I could see in his eyes, he was reliving the video of watching them. And he said, I can't imagine what was behind them that would cause them to want to jump. And again, city officials, firefighters, police officers, we kept feeding them. We kept going to them. And those police officers were making overtime money hand over fist. But our food wasn't to save them money. Our food was to say, "Hey, you're not forgotten. Hey, we have not forgotten about you. God still loves you." We took food to every checkpoint on the tunnels. I'd just like to say that in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon, my 17-year-old and 15-year-old daughter were in charge of breakfast. We got our eggs, 60,000 eggs at a time, and they would start cracking eggs at 2 o'clock in the morning so they could have breakfast ready. And when we went to Ground Zero, in New York, my 13-year-old daughter said, "I want to go help. I want to go help." So her 15-year-old sister said, "Okay, you go in my stead." So my 17 and 13-year-old daughters went to Ground Zero, and we were there until almost till Christmas time. And right now, that 13-year-old daughter, her name's Deborah Sauter. She's on staff at Seacoast Church.
Yeah,
she has grown up in the ministry. And God has used that. They are both on the 9/11 registry because of health issues, lung respiratory issues that they contracted when they were at Ground Zero. We did not know. And I, as a dad, we have 11 children. And these two of my 11 have lifetime respiratory issues because of the air they breathe. In New York, their lungs were not fully developed. I had respiratory issues, but we were able to combat that and reverse it and fix it through medicine. But my lungs were fully developed. Theirs were not. And my daughter, Deborah, was at a healing service there at Seacoast in 2018, and God healed her respiratory issues.
Yep. Yep. We have her on the podcast.
And that's kind of coming full circle with where we started, what we did, and where we're at today. Oh.
You know, that day, you look back on it and you try to make sense out of it, right? Like, why did I do what I did? Why did I turn left instead of right? And when I think about it, broken down into small steps, it's literally, you got to put your left foot in front of your right foot and then take a next step. You can't go any further, double back, and then make a right turn. We made thousands of decisions that day, Joe and I, and it turned out favorable for us. Why were we saved and others did not? There was no answer for that. I remember just the sound of fire engine sirens. This is months afterwards. All of a sudden, my heart rate would take off and I'm like looking for an exit.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Denny, we are tipping our hats towards your organization. What you guys accomplished is unbelievable. And we'll definitely put information out there. So the last thing I want to ask everybody, I guess, just out of curiosity, are y'all surprised that here we are 22 years later and we haven't had anything come close? Because I think around that time, I was just thinking, we all know how our worlds change, how airports change, how our mentality changed and all of that. But there's a part of me that thinks, just thinking, this is something like this is going to happen again. And here we are 22 years later. And I mean, is that surprising?
Thinking back at that time, because I traveled all over the world and I saw the security in other countries, and I was in Israel and I got to see what security was like there. We were asleep at the switch. We were a sleeping bear. And when they poked us and we awakened, it's a different country today to be able to plan something like that.
Yeah, on those same lines. No, it doesn't surprise me for that very reason. Yeah. We got caught. We were too comfortable.
Yeah.
We got caught in the season where we were just too comfortable. And God forbid, I don't think that'll happen
right. again. Well, bless you, man, for what you do. I mean, there's not too many people that start gigantic organizations that can respond at that level just to help people. That's amazing. Well, thank y'all both for sharing y'all stories. It's an honor to hear from you guys and what y'all went through.
Thank you for having us.
Awesome. Thanks, Joey.
We'd love for you to join our Facebook group. There's a link in the show notes. Feel free to comment on our 9/11 post and tell us where you were during the attacks. We remember those who risked their lives to save those in great danger, many of those heroes paying the ultimate price on behalf of the victims. We also remember all those lives taken and the mourning families they left behind.